saying how much they want a strong woman. What they really want is a cheerleader.
I'd like someone who's physically very frail and won't stop talking.
I just want what everybody wants. I just seem to have a harder time getting it.
Welcome back to Maximum Film. It is episode 295. I am not Iffy Wadiwe. If you can't tell, then get your ears checked. My sweet, sweet boy is not here this week, but we still have a fantastic episode for you. Joining me, as ever, is the Christmas Zaddy, far from his season, but not far from his powers, Alonzo Duralde. Alonzo, what's good?
Well, you know, it's funny, Drea. I've been seeing a lot of halfway to Halloween going on, where everybody's like, you know, 6 months away. So, and that just means that we're 6 months away from when Hallmark starts showing Christmas movies. So, works for me either way. My what's good, though, is I'm barreling down on finishing my current book, which is training the life force from me. But a dear, dear friend asked, hey, what can I get you in the way of snacks to really, you know, keep you going? And I said, oh, I love chocolate-covered almonds. And, you know, and I'm thinking like the kind you get at the movie theater, you know, sure. Where there's like it's entombed in chocolate. Well,
the healthy snack.
Yeah. Right. Well, no, but I got a healthy snack, as it turns out, because Blue Diamond makes these things that are dark chocolate almonds, but they have a dusting of cocoa powder on the outside, and they're delicious, and I feel far less guilty eating them. So, you know, if you are, like me, a fan of the chocolate almond, but maybe don't want, you know, the thick, decadent kind, there are choices.
This is amazing. That's basically a food group in the pyramid, I'm sure.
An almond with
a dusting of cocoa?
Get the FDA on the line right now.
Yeah, I love it. I support that. Also, what I support is our long, long rich history of having impeccable, incredible guests here at Maximum Film. Today is definitely one of those. I'm so supremely excited. I really wish you could see what she is wearing. So please go to our social media to check that out. But it is a deep honor, and it is really Alonzo and I's responsibility to up our game. Because joining us today is writer and a professor of ethnomusicology at a little place called Juilliard, Fredera Hadley. What's good?
Woo! Hey, what's good? Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Anything of note happening that's bringing you joy these days?
Yes, it's finally spring in New York, and I love gardening and landscaping. And so my father, he's a horticulturalist, and he's coming up to help me do my landscaping next week. And I am like bursting with blooms in my spirit about it. So I'm excited.
I love
a horticulturist and an ethnomusicologist walk into a bar.
Right.
Truly. I love that because it's not going to be, I just saw my parents and my mother walked me through her garden. And what she kept pointing out was how all of the flowers that she picked out matched the purple of her linen covers.
And I'm really like, not mad at it.
Ma'am, I'm not confident any of those are going to last long, but I'm thrilled for you that they match.
That's planning.
Yeah. Here's to your dad really bringing it up to a proper level.
Indeed.
Drea, what's good?
What's good for me, in addition to my aforementioned trip to see The Rentals, which was very good fun, I am absolutely obsessed with this TV show that my friend Cody Heller is the showrunner on, and Cody's actually another previous illustrious guest of ours. It is called Jury Duty. It's on Amazon Freevee, which is one of those new offshoot things, and I literally had to Google how to watch it. I'm like,
to be IMDb TV.
Yeah. And so you can go through Amazon, but essentially they've set it up so you can see it for free. It will just give you ads. So it's like living in 1982 all over again. But Jury Duty is wonderful. The exec producers on it are from like The Office and other very well-known American comedies. And the whole premise is they somehow cast the so far, don't quote me on this, but so far, the most charming, unproblematic white man in America to play. He thinks that he is taking part in a jury that a documentary has covered, but everyone else around him is cast, including actor James Marsden, who is playing a fictionalized version of himself that's been roped into jury duty. And it follows them the whole time, and they're like sequestered. They filmed for 17 hours at a time. Like, it is so fully committed. And a lot of the cast, I was like, how does this guy not know? But he is also such a genuine, earnest person, and you are rooting for him. And most importantly, he's never the butt of the joke, which I get very uncomfortable with that sort of thing. And this is more, oh my gosh, how nice to just see this man at every turn make the most wholesome response to any given scenario. Anyway, jury duty, very funny, but also a really interesting kind of TV experience. So
I need to catch up with that one.
Well, you can do it for just the cost of watching a few ads. There you go.
I was a Joe Schmo fan, so, you know.
Yes, and they were very inspired by that. Same sort of serendipitous casting, I think. So.
Gotcha.
All right. On today's show, ironically, we're going to be watching something that involved no casting because it's about real life. That's right. We are going to discuss documentary Little Richard, I Am Everything, and why that is an appropriate subtitle for it. We will also then keep the music playing with a hotline question about fictional bands. But first, it is time for It a Dick, which is our movie news segment when we break down the latest in movie news and discuss, is this important? Do I care? Can't wait to see what all of us think about these articles. Alonzo, you want to kick us off?
Oh, certainly. So, if you've been anywhere near Twitter in the past couple of weeks, you already know about the ongoing blue check verification drama. Mine is gone. Oh, well, adios. In short, only those now who are paying for Twitter Blue are supposed to have a blue check next to their name. But many celebrities, including several who have passed on to another realm, and I don't mean just left Twitter. I mean, they're dearly departed, have found their blue checks restored, even though they are not Twitter Blue subscribers. Jennifer Lopez, Selena Gomez, Oprah Winfrey, and the late Chadwick Boseman and Paul Walker are just a few of the accounts who have been blessed with this unrequested check. Is this important? Do you care?
This is, tangentially movie news, but I don't care. I'm happy for us to have a forum to join in. The idea of not even escaping this mortal coil being far enough to get away from Elon Musk, like, just, ugh.
Is it the Mormons who can baptize you after you're dead?
Like, yes. There is something about this whole scenario is so ridiculous. But I'll say it's even more ridiculous when you try and explain it to someone like my parents that I just saw. What's going on? Me trying to talk my parents in the 30 seconds before my dad tapped out about Elon Musk's overview of Twitter and verifications, because this was all happening as they were like, what's a check? What's, and I was like, oh, it is. It's even dumber when you say it out loud.
Yeah.
It truly is. Fredera, are you on Twitter?
Marginally. I have an account there, and I do drive-bys on it, but it mostly feels like a hellscape. I can't stay there for long. And this was, in all honesty, before Elon Musk bought it. It just felt very loud and chaotic for me. And so now learning about this, it's just like, he's chaos agent with it. And, I think when he first bought it, people thought like, oh, Twitter would crash and burn. But that's not what's happening as much as it's just this weird, unstable thing that some people don't want to play in anymore. Some people don't know how to play in anymore. And it's lost this sort of playfulness or whatever was great about it. It's slowly just seeping away out of the balloon.
And go ahead, Alonzo.
I said, maybe I'm a conspiracy theorist, but I kind of feel like that he is deliberately broken it. It's easy to make fun of how much money he's lost on the thing. But given now that if anybody who is using Twitter as a source of news now has to sort of play a long game to figure out, is this person the person they say they are? Is this really MIT? Is this really, you know, French's mustard, whoever, you know, that I'm supposed to be getting this information from? And I can't help feeling like, as a thin-skinned billionaire who hates the media telling the truth about him, you know, he's gone out of his way to discredit this portal that has been of great use to, you know, when you look at, like, you know, the attempted revolution in Iran from to the Black Lives Matter protests. I mean, like, this was a really valuable way for people to share direct information. And now it's, like you said, he's an agent of chaos and he's left just a lot of rubble behind.
And I'll say on the movie side of it, in addition to, you know, celebrities or artists or filmmakers being easily impersonated at this point and whatever ramifications we'll see of that, what Alonzo's talking about, I'm like, I'm an indie filmmaker who may have a film coming out this year, who maybe really could use the support of the grassroots reach out that a social media platform like Twitter could provide. And now the like, oh, so now we to even get posted, we'd have to pay. And because you're such a dork, it means I don't want to pay because that blue check signifies that I'm also a dork. So, like,
that's really why I love the whole scale. Like, you know, not me. I did not. They thrust it on me. No, I did not. You know, and like, it's so uncool to have paid for a blue check that everybody wants to make sure that that they didn't.
It is. I think it's Slate did an article like a masterclass in the opposite of good businessship of how he like absolutely the idea that your biggest endorsements are people saying, oh, no. And that he is now also putting them on it. Yeah. And like as punishment.
I've seen it compared to the Dr. Seuss story, The Sneetches, where they're constantly having their stars taken off or put back on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ridiculous. All right. Well, speaking of movies and other absurdities, Joaquin Phoenix warns fans to not take mushrooms before Bo is Afraid. Bo is Afraid, Ari Aster's three-hour opus, is in theaters now. Reactions have been sharply divided. There is one reaction that star Joaquin Phoenix really wants fans to steer clear of: a bad trip. Phoenix heard anecdotally that some college students were daring each other to take mushrooms before the film. In an interview with Fandango, the actor told potential viewers that, unequivocally, they should not do that. Is this important? Do you care?
I mean, I guess I appreciate the public service announcement aspect of this. He's right. You shouldn't. I might go further and say you maybe don't even need to see the movie, but that's just me. I know a lot of people are really loving it and think it's great. But yeah, I think we can all come together as a nation and say, no, don't take mushrooms if you're going to see Bo is Afraid.
I haven't seen it. My sister-in-law saw it and texted me and just said, have you seen this? Question. I could hear her reaction in the simple question. And I was like, no, a three-hour Ari Aster film about, like, mother issues? I'll be watching that probably at home while I do a jigsaw puzzle. There's no confronting that with no escape route. Like, no, thank you. So the idea, very true. Do I want to add shrooms to that? Oh, I certainly do not.
No.
I'm trying to think of what I would if I was going to program a lineup of these are the movies you should take mushrooms to.
Yeah, because right? It
but
seems
there
like
weren't the obvious, like, Wizard of Oz or whatever.
A lot of relatively innocuous movies could become a bad idea on shrooms. So yeah, Bo is Afraid, absolutely. Mm-mm.
Alonzo, are you going to lead with My Dinner with Andre? Get them shrooms going and sit down for dinner.
I hadn't thought about that, but you know, I'll tell you, those guys do really like paint a picture with words. So maybe.
That's true. Listen, as someone who did once take shrooms and stare at a ceiling for at least 2 hours, and I repeated numerous times, why have we never looked at this before? Yeah, then My Dinner with Andre is certainly an option for that program. Fridera, Bo is Afraid, shrooms.
Yes.
Any thoughts?
Yeah, in general, I mean, like, I just feel like you were saying, you were staring at the ceilings. I feel like that's the best situation for any type of edible mushroom. Just be somewhere and be still, like, not in a movie theater with, like, a complicated plot line. Like,
right.
Just hold steady at home, someplace comfortable. Enjoy
that's like the main scenario
out.
Where you don't need, like,
extra stimuli.
Right?
No.
Throw on Koyaanisqatsi if you want, but, you know, like, why Gilda Lily?
Solid. A solid Alonzo reference that now everyone can go Google.
There you go. And speaking of movies probably not to watch on mushrooms, news reports say that writers Christina Hodson of Birds of Prey and The Flash and Oren Uziel of Cloverfield will be taking on the script for the next Fast and Furious sequel. Yes, that's right. The next Fast and Furious sequel. Buried in the lead of that article is the fact that despite previous assurances that Fast X would be the final chapter of the Family is Everything saga, of course it's not, because there's still money to be made by Universal Pictures and so many others. Is this important? Do you care?
Well, one thing, Oren Uziel wrote the Cloverfield Paradox. Not the original one, if you want to change
big difference.
That. Yeah, yeah. But this, it is funny because they slipped out at some point in the last year or whatever. Like, it was this very quiet, like, oh, Fast X is just the first part of a two-part finale. And I'm like, yes, because everything famously ends on the 11th version of anything. You know, like, that's...
Clocks.
What a solid round number. It's such a, like... Twilight did that too, right? Like, it's such a big
Harry Potter,
final story.
The bifurcated last chapter. Yeah,
this is even funnier to me because, again, you know, I love to skip a trailer, but you can't in the theater. And so, getting to watch the Fast X trailer on the big screen and be confronted with just how amazingly stupid it's going to be, I was like, yes. Well, they clearly really tightened the storytelling just to, like, how do you condense this all? How do you get, I'm like, it is all nonsense. Like, even the trailer, I'm like, I'm so, what is happening? Like, you just
Once you've gone to space, Drea, what's left?
It's true. You need all that extra time to deny physics. Oh, I will say these two are really interesting writers, though. That Christina Hodson, I'm obviously, we've spoken about, like, the Birds of Prey, I adored. I thought what she did with Harley Quinn and
absolutely,
especially the women around her and in that world was really exciting, and both knew the source material well, but gave us interesting characters with grit and complications to them. And Oren Uziel also has a nice background. And they're also two writers who have never written together before, which is a fun pairing. And the idea of, like, yeah, I mean, this is a nonsense world. Let's both get in on this. This will be what a fun challenge. And that they're doing it together rather than that thing that these franchises tend to get, which is 15 credited writers
because they keep
getting paid to do rewrites. Yeah.
That's one of those pop culture things that completely missed me, or I completely missed it. I'm not going to say it with pride, but I don't think I've ever seen a single one in its entirety. And not like because I'm like, oh no, I'm too good for it. It just never really happened. So I know that they exist. I've seen trailers and bits and pieces, and I was going to ask, just how many are there?
Well, Fast X, the X stands for 10.
10.
So, you know.
I am shocked that the Fast and Furious franchise is not something that's coming up in the ethnomusicology department of Juilliard. Honestly, shocked.
Our standards are slipping.
I got to go back to my colleagues. We got to talk
what
about
is this country even coming to? Yeah.
No, as I always tell people, I envy you getting to see them for the first time.
Truly. Honestly, rope in a group of friends and do like a year of viewing. One a month. Skip a couple months.
Or just start with five.
Or start with five. Five is great. Five is great. Five's still maybe the best one. But they're fun. And the best part about them is they're so uniquely stupid, and they're very fun to discuss in a good group view. So
for sure.
I don't.
Yes.
We are
But don't take mushrooms, though.
Don't take mushrooms. Yeah. All right.
I'm going to take y'all up on that suggestion, truly.
Yeah, yeah. There's no topping that. So we are going to take a break. But when we come back, we're going to be talking about the real king of rock and roll, Little Richard.
Hi, I'm Jackie Cation.
Hello, I'm Lori Kilmerton.
We do a podcast called The Jackie and Lori Show, and you could listen to it anytime you want it because there's hundreds of episodes.
Yeah, I mean, we've been doing comedy forever, and we should both quit. So why don't you listen up before we leave this not only terrible business, but this awful world.
And find out why we can't. Because we love it so.
Jackie and Lori Show, every week here on MaximumFun.org.
Welcome back to Maximum Film. I am today's host, Drea Clark. In the studio with me are
Alonzo Duralde
and Pradera Hadley.
Today's film premiered at a little festival in Utah called Sundance that I might have discussed before in my life. This very January, it also won the Grand Jury Prize for Documentary. And our guest, Pradera Hadley, of The Amazing Shirt That You Cannot See, was also one of the featured experts interviewed in the film. So fancy, so smart, so wonderful. What a get for us. The film is directed by Lisa Cortez. Alonzo, would you mind giving us a brief synopsis of Little Richard, I Am Everything?
Yeah, so the film is a celebration of Little Richard as a cultural pioneer, as one of the key architects of rock and roll, as somebody who's outrageous onstage stylings and androgyny continue to reverberate to this day. There would be no Elvis, there would be no David Bowie, there would be no Lil Nas X without Little Richard. But it's also about Richard Penniman as a conflicted man who was, you know, raised in the church but was queer in the mid-20th century and who vacillated back and forth between the hedonism of rock and roll and the structure and the apocalyptic nature of evangelical religion. It is an overdue celebration of an American legend and an exploration of an artist whose work continues to matter. Little Richard, I Am Everything.
Little Richard, honestly, maybe the most American of subjects I've ever seen. I mean, like what Alonzo was just saying, that within one person, so many both competing and just existing elements were swirling about. It's truly was so fascinating to see laid out because also, as I mean, we maybe are of different ages. Alonzo and I have discussed that before. He knows I am ageless, so it's hard to pin me down. But also, I live in and always did in a world where Little Richard was a very known and recognizable fixture. And so getting this insight into something that just seemed like never ending and like, oh,
there has always been a Little
Richard.
There has
always been. And so it's a really, I love getting to deep dive into something that you thought you knew, but really get to explore in these other more interesting cultural ways. Why is that now? Like, why is this coming out now for a man that has been around for so long? We did just lose a couple of years ago. But not only why is it being made, but why is it important to acknowledge these contributions that he made to American music and to culture and to identity and representation and everything else?
Yeah, I think it's important because, and I'm assuming we're all about the same age, right? Like we grew up in the world that Little Richard created. Like we grew up knowing so many of the artists that he inspired as megastars. Like, you know, Beatlemania had happened. David Bowie was huge. Elvis had died by the time I was born. Like all of those things had happened already. And we were living in the world shaped by those musical and cultural forces. And we grew up with Little Richard still here on Earth with us. He just passed, I think, in 2020. But the height of the frenzy of his career had also already happened. And so we knew him as a guy who might pop up on TV or in a commercial or in a concert or something like that and be extraordinarily talented and have this energy about him and be funny. He could be so wickedly funny. But we couldn't, because we lived in the world that he created, we couldn't hear the innovation. This is something that I talk as a music historian, ethnomusicologist, I talk to my students a lot about, like, we were talking about hip hop. Like, they can't, I have to do work to make them understand what a world before hip hop sounded like. And so it's the same for us, I think. What the film helps us do is imagine how, or witness how, Little Richard changed the world to hear the innovation that he brought to music, to performance, that simply was not there in the same way before he blew up. The fact that, you know, when if you would think that he's lying when he says some of these things out loud, that Jimi Hendrix was in his band, that he discovered James Brown. Like, you would think that he's making these things up, but he absolutely isn't. And, you know, like, the truth is more fantastic than anything that we could script when it comes to Little Richard.
My friend Lori Pike said the genius of Madonna is that she's always the third person to do something. The first two are like these guys in France you never heard of, and then Madonna does it and brings it out to the world. And the tragedy of Little Richard is that he wasn't the third person to do anything. He was the first. And so, you know, you see, like, he's just too much for the world. He's too queer. He is too black for pop culture in the 50s. They have to, like, you know, they give his songs to fucking Pat Boone, to just neuters them in the most, like, horror. It's the kind of thing you see and you think, this is something that if I saw in a satire about the 50s, I wouldn't believe it. Yeah. But it happened. Pat Boone singing Tutti Frutti is just like one of the great, like, you know, blasphemies of our century. It is kind of just fascinating to see him just create from whole cloth rock and roll, essentially. And it's really interesting to see this movie right after Baz Luhrmann's Elvis, because Little Richard becomes this sort of side character in, like, Elvis and in Get On Up, the James Brown biopic that starred Chadwick Boseman. But it's like, nah, he's the guy steering the ship and they're all scribbling notes behind him, you know. And I think this movie really, like, puts him in the proper cultural context and really, you know, kind of makes you appreciate that, like, you don't have Prince's, you know, side button velveteen pants from Purple Rain without Little Richard. You don't have, you know, John Waters's mustache without Little Richard. All of these points of iconography. But then you also see where Little Richard came from. Yes. And who he borrowed from and who his stylistic influences were. And so it just becomes this long chain of, you know, kind of cultural phenomena.
That's what I meant about the truly American part of him, because when they started to show the gospel singers that he was inspired or collaborated with, Sister Rosetta Tharpe, I think it's her. I remember weirdly being introduced to her from a small clip from the beginning of Ghost World, when one of the characters is, like, flipping through channels. And I was like, who is this incredible black woman with the guitar? Like, what am I? What am I? Is this a dream? And so watching, because that's such, to me, an American process, like watching this man take the music that he grew up with, that he feels, and that is also, like, again, the Pat Boone stuff I felt so acutely, because I was like, oh God, it's like looking in a mirror. I just, these are my people.
The crushing whiteness of it all.
Yeah, just the reality of it. But the idea of watching the gospel singers that he was inspired by, and also there's like a vocal, well, I'm sorry, I'm embarrassed to be discussing this in front of Fredera with my just random knowledge, but there's just this vocal inhibition that's happening, and the idea of being in service to the Lord. Like, there's they also say within his life that his mother went to the Baptist church and his father went to the evangelical, and the even the different service styles influenced him, and looking at that and that sort of full-throated just giving over to the passion of a moment, if it's religious fervor or not, and then having that then filter into something like Tutti Frutti, which he then goes on later to be like, Yeah, or that one of the other experts is like, that's about anal sex. That song is...
It's about penetration.
And you're... Right? And I was like, that's the American confluence. Like, oh, sure, you're going to take these things, you're going to mash them with this talent and voice, and then bring in this queer perspective. And also, I never knew that, because again, I'm the Pat Boone of this show. I was like, I never knew. Good for you, Tutti Frutti. Good for you.
For now, I have a question, just because for me, there's one sort of jump that the movie makes that I couldn't follow. And I don't know if it's sort of a cutting room floor situation or what, but we go from Little Richard's sort of like, it's funny, he and Dylan both had their like born again moment. Mm-hmm. You know, he leaves rock and roll. He
so
goes,
did Prince.
Oh, that's true. You're right. Yeah. So Little Richard leaves rock and roll. He goes to seminary. You know, he settles down, gets married, records some gospel albums, and then because of financial need, goes to England in the early 60s and just blows the roof off. And I guess I missed the transition of him re-embracing rock and roll there. And do you know what happened in there? Was it purely a business decision, or did other things change over the course of his marriage and his, you know, re-involvement with the church?
So it's interesting that you asked that, because I just actually went to the theater this past Friday and just saw it, right? That was my first time really watching it. And it just so happened that Lisa Cortez was doing a talk back at that same viewing, right?
Did she bring you up? I hope she brought you up.
She did. She was like, there's someone from the movie here in the audience. And so that was my cue. But she talked about that because she talks about him coming to the UK, and there's some discrepancy. He does two concerts when he gets there, like the first two shows in that run. And one of the, she thinks what happens is the first night he sings mostly gospel, and he's not singing his rock and roll catalog, and he gets a lukewarm reception. The next night he comes back and he sings Tutti Frutti, you know, all of his hits, and it goes through the roof. And I feel like, and I love what you said earlier about Little Richard and Richard Penniman, like, and the film gives you both of those people, and they're both equally real, right? And you know, just my sort of thinking about him is, he needed that adulation. He told people as much. You know, he would chastise audiences if they didn't give it to him. And so I think it was unbearable for him, and unsustainable long term, to occupy any kind of musical space that did not come with that frenzy and that adulation. And some of the footage she shows in there, like, I had certainly never seen before, but just the intensity, the energy, the fervor, the sexuality, the sensuality that he exuded on stage that whipped everybody into a frenzy was stunning, even through the screen decades later. Like, it was like, I get it. I get it. I get why people thought he was dangerous and why they needed to sideline him. I get why people loved him. My dad is a Baptist deacon in Florida, and my dad loves Little Richard. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's his guy. He loves Little Richard. But, like, that's dangerous in 1950. Like, from Macon, Georgia, you know, like...
Hugely. That's all,
yeah.
I mean, speaking... So, there's a performer named Alton Mason, who's the one that plays young Little Richard in Elvis, which we talked about, which I remember looking up because... He just does, like, one performance, and I was so taken. Just, I was like, oh, is there footage of Little Richard from that? Like, I would like to see that. And it is. It's this kismet. And it's also the filmmaker Lisa Cortez brings it in this sort of universe imagery that we keep getting, and him talking about being, like, a quasar or something.
Quasar of rock and roll.
The brightest star.
Right, yeah. The brightest star. But it really is. It's not just the, oh, you had this voice. Like, sure, I've seen, like there's some beautiful documentaries on Whitney Houston, and you're like, oh, the voice. Little Richard, the brazenness of identity at that, I mean, at any age, but, like, we look at how many people are traumatized and going through it right now, and the idea of him in the 50s being like, oh, I'm going to be sassy. I'm going to be queer. I'm going to be in your face about all of it. And you're also going to enjoy it because watch me shine. Like him on stage and all he's doing, but that it's just the flamboyance is part of it. You don't get one without the other. It is all part of the magnetism that he's bringing. And there is such an, I mean, we've talked about this before, especially my natural reticence of using the term bravery for anything is particularly in the queer space because it can be really condescending, but that freaking was like the idea of, are you kidding me? Like getting on stage, particularly as a Black artist in the South, like from beat one being like, this is who I am. And then of course having, like you said, the religious convergences later on and all of that complications, but watching that and admiring, like, beyond the musicianship. So I guess that leads to the next thing, because I also was not aware of, there were the larger relationships, and I'd certainly seen the stuff with Mick Jagger or David Bowie acknowledging the presence, but we also get to meet a few transgender and drag, like, kind of smaller performers who nod to him. Was any of that new, or were you guys both aware of those relationships? And
it was new to me. I mean, I've always known about Little Richard's queerness, but I was never clear about how that manifested in terms of other queer performers of the era, since, I mean, there weren't a lot of them, and a lot of them, I think, do operate sort of on kind of a nightclub, you know, drag level, and some of the quote-unquote drag performers of that period were trans women. And so, yeah, that was really fascinating to know that he would have that connection and there was that understanding between them that they are coming from the same place.
Well, I knew about Esperita. I didn't know about some of the others that he built community with, you know, and had all kinds of complex human relationships with. And that's also why I think that documentary is so important. I say it in the film, you know, I grew up in the 80s where I thought rock and roll was white because I grew up in like glam rock hair band era. And so that's just what I thought. Right. And so really, truly, I keep coming back to this question. What does it do about how we think about American music if we have to accept that the popularizers, one of the key innovators of what we think of as one of the most American music, rock and roll, is a queer Southern Black person. That undoes so much of our mythology around music and race and masculinity. Like, it blows that out of the water. And for me, that is a portal to greater freedom for everybody to be able to imagine themselves in whatever kind of space they need to imagine themselves in.
Yeah, white culture stole country music, rock music, and cowboys from Black people. And I do love, you're right. I think this movie goes a long way in sort of expressing the idea that rock and roll is at its core kind of faggy, and that's awesome, you know, and that's part of what's exciting about it and what's transgressive about it and what's, you know, dangerous about it. And all of that is wrapped up in Little Richard and his presentation on stage, off stage, everything that he was, you know, giving to an audience, as the movie reminds us, like, this is the Emmett Till period, you know, and he is, you know, I think you do get to say bravery in this context because, you know, this is the thing where literally, you know, you see like some headlines of the police hauling him off and stuff, like lynchings were happening, you know, and he is forthrightly putting himself out there and putting himself out there in a sexual context in shows where Black and white teenagers are, you know, co-mingling in the balconies, you know. So, yeah, this is it is so transgressive and so just, you know, throwing out all of the mores of that moment, that horrible, repressive, like as bad as everything in America is and always has been, the 50s was particularly shitty, I think. You know, Dave always likes to say everything looked great and everybody was miserable unless you were a straight white Christian man.
Yeah. I think, too, that there's another phrase in this that I loved, and I'm glad you brought up Esquisita. I hope I'm saying
Esperita.
Okay. And that who had a very similar look. And the idea of Little Richard says something about how people had you know, called him out later for kind of biting that style. But instead, it was actually like, oh, no, I was mirroring something. I found someone in my community who had the same sort of expressiveness and representation that I did. And I think there's such a great undercurrent in this on top of his role in America, in rock and roll, in American history and culture. But also, I loved how this movie explored the idea of identity and just raw pride in that. Because he also has several beautiful speeches where he compliments himself and is like, I'm not conceited. And I was like, he's not. He's like, I am that moment. And I'm like, I mean, you are. You're not wrong. Like, he was like, I was beautiful. And I was like, you were, certainly. I saw that picture. Agreed, sir.
Yeah. Speaking about Lou Richard and his southernness and his queerness, it helps to understand, like, shows like P-Valley, where that comes from. Because with the South, with all of it, you know, a history of racial terror and now political disenfranchisement, Black people have always had to find what I would call hush harbors, places where they could gather and be themselves, even especially queer Black people. But they have found ways to imagine and to enact who they want to be. And so we see these through lines of how that happens, particularly in the South. And Zandria Robinson, who's in the documentary as well, she talks about how she's proudly from Memphis, Tennessee. And I'm a Southerner as well. I should say I'm from Florida. Please send me cards of condolence. But she talks about how she thinks about the South fundamentally as a queer space where people have to kind of flip and navigate and sort of, you know, transfigure and all of these things to survive. And she uses the term conjuring, like, and I think very much of him as a conjurer because he's able to embody so much. Part of the frenzy is perhaps that we imagine we can do the same thing. You know what I'm saying? And what a gift, but what a costly gift to Richard Penniman, right? And that's the complexity of what we're left to grapple with in watching the film.
Beautiful. I'm going to dismount from that perfect statement to our voting of this film. On this show, we rank things as screen it, which is your highest accolade, stream it, or skip it. Alonzo, do you want to go first? Show her how it's done.
Absolutely. Oh, I'm for sure a screen it here. I love a documentary that tells me things I didn't know about somebody that I assumed I knew everything about. I learned a lot. I learned a lot about the specifics of Richard's life, but also the larger scope of why he matters and why he's important. And, you know, I tend to forget of him as the queer icon that he is. And, you know, we don't have nearly enough of them in this country that reached the level that he did and that had the impact that he did, certainly not in the 1950s. I was moved. I was thrilled. I learned a few things. I recommend this to everybody. By all means, yes, screen it.
Excellent. Fredera.
I'm not biased at all. I would say screen it, but you know, like I said, I went and saw it as someone shoot these things so long ago that you forget what you even said.
Right.
And so I really did walk into the theater kind of like anybody else. And I was struck by how entertaining it was. It was informative in the ways that you hope a documentary is. And a large part of that is because of who Little Richard is. Like, mm-hmm. He's just an entertaining person. But also, I loved, you know, the kind of pixie dust she wove throughout and made it like this really kind of beauty in the way it was shot, like this beautiful thing to watch, and weaving in these performances of current day musicians like Corey Henry, Valerie June, John P. Key to really kind of emphasize these musical trajectories he was involved in. And I just like communal watching. I like watching things with people. So it was great to hear people laughing at certain junctures or remembering songs at different moments. So I say, great.
All right. Well, I'm going to round out this trifecta with a screen it of my own. This is a very enjoyable movie, and it's certainly no part of this is going to feel educational, but are you going to be able to drop some knowledge on all your friends after you see it? It is a very fun ride, and if you are me, it is going to make you really want to step up your accessories and sparkly clothing game. All right, we will be right back after we hear from another show from Maximum Fun.
I'm sure you've noticed how giant corporations are controlling more and more about what we consume, whether it's our food, our news, or even the shows we enjoy.
The Greatest Generation is a show that stands up to big Star Trek and says no. We can laugh about costumes that fit too tightly in the groin area.
We can make a Star Trek podcast that's basically only about that.
The Greatest Generation, the show for free and independent thinkers about Star Trek.
And the groins of different costumes.
Reviewing every episode in order.
So subscribe to The Greatest Generation on MaximumFun.org. You'll be doing your part in telling the Star Trek industrial complex that they can't control your mind.
Welcome back to Maximum Film. I'm your host, Drea Clark, and in the studio with me are...
Fredera Hadley.
Alonzo Duralde.
We talked about a real-life music legend today, so why not cap things off with some fake musical stars? We're doing that in the form of a hotline letter from Rachel, and our buddy super producer Marissa is here to read that letter.
Hello. I'm not going to do any voices. I thought about it, but I don't want to steal Iffy's bit. So, Rachel, I hope you're not too sad. If you're still listening, I think this email is from a million years ago, but it was appropriate, and it's a timeless question that will still make sense now, after however many months it's been. Okay. Hello, Rachel says. Longtime listener, first-time emailer. I recently found my old iPod that contained music from the 1998 movie Still Crazy, a film that I loved in college. If you haven't seen it, Still Crazy is a British comedy about a fictional 1970s rock band and their attempts to reunite for a festival 20 years after their turbulent breakup. The movie is ridiculous and hilarious, but also, their songs kind of slap. Do you have any favorite fictional bands whose songs you would non-ironically listen to? Besides That Thing You Do, of course. That's just a given. Love the show. Thanks, Rachel.
Good question.
Yeah. Do you guys want to hear what the band from Still Crazy sounds
like? Sure.
All right. I'll play it for you. I looked into this today because I'd never seen Still Crazy. I don't know if you guys had ever seen it.
I've heard of it, but I've never seen it.
Bill Nighy is the front man, which is super fun. The band, super weirdly, that they are reuniting is called Strange Fruit, which is troubling. But
the British do love to glom themselves onto blues culture, you know.
Yeah. Ooh, just a bunch of old white guys, but okay, sure. I guess they're just counting on nobody understanding.
Maybe next time Google the origins of the term before you make a fake band.
You know what? Haven't seen this movie, maybe they address it.
Fair.
Here's a little bit of the song. We're crossing the borders of innocence. We're breaking down the walls of time. All over the world, it's a happening. It's happening tonight. All the world. Just a little taste for you there. I thought you might appreciate that, and the listeners as well. So I'd love to hear your answers to this great question.
I had one immediately come to mind because I absolutely bought the soundtrack just because I liked the fictional song so much. And I'm realizing this is, again, another real diary moment, possibly too much insight into the life of Drea Clark. But yeah, Josie and the Pussycats.
Thank you. Yes.
So good. Okay. Whew. So the singer, it's the singer from Letters to Cleo.
Kay Hanley.
And I mean, like Adam Schlesinger wrote one of at least a few of the songs.
Oh, a murderer's row of pop songwriters collaborated on all those, like Jane Wiedlin and Jason Faulkner and all kinds of folk. That
I feel very vindicated that you both nodded so quickly.
That is no, that was absolutely going to be one of mine. I mean, the Josie and the Pussycat soundtrack is perfection from.
I know.
From
I still know every word. Start in to fact, finish. I'm like, well, I gotta go find that CD again, and then I have to, you know, find a CD player.
I got to go to a 20th anniversary screening that they did at the Ace Hotel when Mondo released the soundtrack on vinyl for the first time. And not only did like the three actresses all reunite on stage, but Kay Hanley and the band from the movie came out and did a couple of songs, and I thought my head was going to explode.
Oh, I would love that so much. I love that. I also have a real soft spot for Josie and the Pussycats, the movie.
Yes.
Obviously, I would like someone, speaking of Twitter, call back to 15 years earlier when we were talking about that. Someone tweeted recently that they want an origin story TV series on Parker Posey's character from Josie and the Pussycats.
Would
the
watch.
And I was like, yeah, I would watch 10 hours of that. No problem. It has to be Parker Posey.
Of course.
You have to do they need to do the Irishman de-aging of her. But I would watch it. So,
whatever
okay,
it takes. No, that's classic choice. Fernando, what you got?
Two things came to mind, actually. One was Spike Lee's 1988 film, School Days, which is a musical, which is set on a fictional college campus. And so all of the bands in that film are fictional bands.
Such a good point.
And so except for the band that does Debut, they're real.
They came together for that. Movie.
Oh, really? Oh, I don't know. Maybe.
I can't think of another song that they had besides the butt, right? And so you have some great, like, kind of musical theater numbers. You have, like, a little bit of everything in that movie. And so I thought about that. And then I thought more recently, during the pandemic, I binge watched the cartoon Steven Universe.
Ooh.
The music on that show is phenomenal. Like, it has a phenomenal score. Estelle is one of the characters, and she has some beautiful songs that she sings in the show. But the character who's like a little kid, he has a band called Steven the Steven, and it's just this little rock band. But their songs are actually decent, and they're really, really cute and catchy. Like, I thought about Steven Universe. Those are my two kind of different points in time, but. Solid. I'm rocking with it.
I have a funny School Days story. My first boyfriend came home and caught me lip syncing to
I
don't want to be alone tonight. Yes.
That's the ultimate lip sync, though.
Yes.
You got to do the moves to
of
it.
Of course.
Though.
Yes. I was doing full Jasmine Guy. Of course.
Yes.
You got it.
Don't get too excited. He does full Jasmine Guy to every song.
That's true. It's kind of my
thing.
That's
his move.
So I was going to bring up Josie and the Pussycats, but Drea got there. So my other one, I'm going to reach back a bit. There's a 1982 Australian comedy called Starstruck from director Gillian Armstrong. It was her follow-up to My Brilliant Career, which was like the movie that kind of put her on the map around the world. But this is a very kind of like, let's put on a show, plucky young girl who wants to be a rock singer and gets involved with the band, and they have to like crash the big New Year's Eve show at the Opera House so they can win the talent contest and save the pub. The songs are all written by Neil Finn of Crowded House and are super catchy. And the title theme is great. There's a song called The Monkey in Me that's awesome. Another character does this song called I Want to Live in a House. It is another soundtrack I have committed to memory. So if you've never seen Starstruck, lucky you, you get to watch it for the first time. But the movie is fun and colorful and wacky, but the songs are all dynamite.
It's so good, and I entirely saw that movie because Alonzo did it as a staff pick like years ago, and I was like, what? That sounds amazing, and it does, and because it's from the early 80s, I just thought that those were actual songs. So, bravo to
them. That's the best part.
Yeah. I do have one other that I would add, which is the band from every single song that the kid band from Sing Street plays.
Oh, yes.
Is
oh,
fantastic.
That's such a good pick.
Drive It Like You Stole It should have gotten an Oscar nomination.
Drive It Like You Stole It? I'll listen to that every day. And they're also...
The Riddle of the Model.
Right? The whole shaping of them is that they keep getting influenced by different artists and then it filters into their work. So there's like an aha type. There's a Cure type. And every single song is fantastic. Go get the Sing Street soundtrack. It's so good.
That music is so good. I thought of a couple answers, just I thought we might have time.
Sure.
I would say actually both of my two answers are a little bit more like metal than my music taste kind of is. But my most watched movie of all time, for whatever reason, it is the movie Wayne's World. And the band Crucial Taunt from Wayne's World, headed by Tia Carrera. Man, she can wail as... They're
better than the Shitty Beatles.
Shitty Beatles. And then Hedwig and the Angry Inch, which I thought might come up.
Absolutely.
Yes, just really.
One of my favorite sort of subgenres is movies about fictional bands, like We Are the Best and Ladies and Gentlemen, The Fabulous Stains. Like there's just tons of them.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for your great question, Rachel. And I'll leave you guys to do some staff picks.
Excellent. All right. So as Marissa said, now it is time for staff picks. We are all going to recommend something. It can be any movie at all from the wide world and history, time and space of motion picture. Alonzo, would you like to go first?
I would love to. So this movie is actually mentioned in the Little Richard documentary. It is the brilliant Frank Tashlin rock and roll musical, The Girl Can't Help It. And John Waters talks about how it was the first time he'd ever actually gotten to see Little Richard on screen. It's a crazy movie in a lot of ways, partially because Tashlin came from the world of Warner Brothers animation. Like he was one of the Looney Tunes guys. And he basically treats Jane Mansfield like a visual gag with her full participation. And so like there's a lot of wild anarchic humor in the film. There's also this amazing parade of rock acts. And whereas most of the kind of like Alan Freed centric rock and roll movies of the period would have these bands playing in the kind of clubs that they were actually playing in, all of the acts here perform in these very upscale supper clubs for some reason, which doesn't make any sense, but it looks great. And so over the course of this movie, you get like the Platters and Gene Vincent and Fats Domino and Abby Lincoln and just all these extraordinary performers and Little Richard. And so it's this great snapshot of the dawn of rock and roll also merged into a really hilarious Jane Mansfield comedy. And Criterion just put out a really great Blu-ray of it.
Excellent. And you will. It also goes into my recurring theme of watching something that will make you wish you were accessorizing and wearing shinier things. Solid choice. Fredera, how about you? A staff pick?
Oh my gosh. I have nothing.
It doesn't have to be related at all.
It can be new. It can be old.
If you could meet a new person and be like, you know what you should watch that I enjoy for reasons, whatever.
I mean, okay, so if we're going to go that way, I'm going to stick with, like, musicals. I'm going to say The Wiz. Because
nice.
I love The Wiz, and one of my happiest moments in life was watching it at Piedmont Park in Atlanta. It was on a summer night, and everybody, you couldn't even hear the movie because everybody knew every word and all the songs. But I would give this caveat. You have to watch The Wiz with someone who loves The Wiz, and then the magic will be unlocked and you will be transported to the Emerald City.
I agree. I'll back
Hot
that
choice.
Up.
Choice.
Maybe when you put together your Fast X group,
you can
fill out one of the two remaining months with The Wiz. Do a repeat viewing.
Just my habit.
There you go. So mine, we're going to do a full genre spin. My pick is a movie called Joyland, which won Best International Film at the Spirit Awards this year. It was Pakistan's entry for the Academy Awards, sort of. And then it faced a lot of strange getting banned and then unbanned. But it is now playing in America, and the theatrical release is currently in a few markets, but it broadens on the 28th. So I think when this episode comes out, I highly recommend checking this out. It is a beautiful film. It is about a small family in a very patriarchal structure who keep having daughters, more and more girls coming into this family to the chagrin of the grandfather. And then you have the kind of father, he's certainly the father of the family, who ends up getting a job as a backup dancer to a transgender performer, and they sparks fly, and there is a love story. There's complication. He is married. There's all sorts of things going on, but it's very personal and very loving and fraught with emotion, but not in the same traumatic way that often comes when you're getting transgender stories. It's a queer film in many different readings of that word, and it is just a great view. You'll watch and be like, oh, that's a movie. That's how you movie.
So that's anyway, a picture.
That's a picture. Joyland deserves your support, and you will, I'm sure, thank me for it. So, huge, tremendous thanks to our guest today, Vera Hadley. What a delight to have you here. So, so lucky. Are there places where people can hear a little bit more about you, support you online, see what you're up to?
I'm the only Fredera on socials, so you can look me up at Fredera on Instagram, on the aforementioned Twitter. You'll find me. And on YouTube, there's lots of stuff of me out there running my mouth about all kinds of musical things. So dive on in. Join the conversation.
That's fantastic. Also, the flex of I'm the only Fredera on social media. Enjoy that moment, ma'am. Enjoy
no
that.
Blue check needed. No
yeah,
blue
check exactly. needed.
You brought your own.
Get checks of all colors unnecessary here. Alonzo, my sweet, thank you for another wonderful show.
My pleasure.
Next week, we will be discussing the new anime film from Makoto Shinkai, Suzume. So check that out in advance if you want to know about it before we discuss it. If you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, tweet at us at @maximum_film. Our Facebook group can be found at www.facebook.com/group/maximumfilm, or send us an email at maximumfilm@maximumfun.org. Our producer is Marissa Flaxbart. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of Maximum Fun. Goodbye.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.